Hello, everybody. I tell you, when I'm not teaching in another class, I just love to sit in on this one. Wayne is one of the nicest things that's ever happened in my whole life. He's so gentle with me. I'm such a wacko. And the fact that he would put up with me is just almost beyond words. He's so precise. He thinks so clearly. I am such a throw it on the wall and hopefully a little piece will stick. So, let's open in prayer, Father, as we hear from Jamie this morning, that the generosity of Scottsdale Bible Church is now $17 million on this campaign and compelled by grace. Oh God, thank you so much that you would help others and many others to see that the legacy that this is going to leave for future generations, that those new churches that are going to open, that the church becoming known for special needs, that everybody in our city knows, oh yes, they really do care for people, for special needs folks. Oh God, I can hardly wait. I just want the next 3 years to pass quickly so we can take a look. Oh Lord, for someone be driving down Shea Boulevard and see a chapel there on the corner of Miller and Shea, to see a beautiful building with a cross on it, sharing maybe a guy with his wife or vice versa, saying, you know, we should stop. We gotta take a look at this thing called Jesus and the spiritual side of life. And perhaps that a chapel will be 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's open. It's open. Come in and let's visit. How about Jesus? Oh God, you've got so many great things coming up, and I'm so blessed that so many, 1,500 couples, see it and want to participate. God, thank you for their generosity. Be with us today as we look at Thatcher and as we look at Proverbs 31, the Proverbs 31 woman. Oh God, thank you for that beautiful, beautiful chapter that you've given. And we're going to look at it today. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. From 1850 through 1950, you have the UK, of course, has been around for 1,000 years, but United States and the UK really put on quite a move economically in that 100-year period of time. And in a sense, even when you get to the year 1950, it goes way deeper than that, because the fact is that the Western world was the only power, the only inventive place, the only creative place on the planet. And when I say the Western world, I mean United States, Europe, and Japan. Who would have imagined that the United States, Europe, and Japan would control the world, so to speak, for 500 years? That anything that happened for 500 years came out of the West. The agricultural revolution, the industrial revolution, and the technological revolution all came out of the West. Really nothing from China, nothing from Muslim countries, literally nothing from South America, nothing from Africa. The West, United States, the UK, and Japan dominated the world. It was the empire for 500 years. Now, as the United States starts adding its part, starting in 1776, it's not that the United States ever set out to be an empire. I don't think most of us would say this about our parents, our grandparents, or ourselves. Yes, we set out to be an empire. I've got to tell you that that's precisely what most other nations do. Our nation goes out to defend and not to conquer, to protect and not possess. But you tell me, many other nations that you know, that go out to defend and not conquer, to protect and not possess. So the United States is part of the West. The West, once again, being Europe, Japan, and the United States. The United States was very, very unique as this empire just kept happening and happening and happening. So we get to 1950, and now the World War II is over. We have an enormous victory over Germany and Japan. And now you begin another little piece of history, and the piece is that most of the world, World War II, end of World War II, we're talking, say, roughly speaking, 1950, we are ready now to embrace, are you ready for this? Socialism. So we come to 1950, and certainly Europe made a left turn towards socialism. The world made a left turn to socialism. I got to tell you that the colonialists did some good and did some harm as they took over Africa. But the biggest harm that they ever thought of doing is to leave the legacy of socialism with Africa. Because the fact of the matter is, Africa practiced nothing but socialism from 1950 through the year 2000. So they go 50 years of socialism. It did not work, it cannot work, it will not work, it has never worked, but nevertheless, they were caught in socialism, and so no economic growth in Africa for 50 years, 1950 through the year 2000. Of course, the UK, as they start bending strong to the left, as Margaret Thatcher said many, many times, the problem with socialism is that eventually you run out of spending other people's money. And that's one of the problems with socialism, of course. And socialism, another problem, everybody's business is nobody's business. If we all own it, nobody owns it. Because if we all own it, no one has particular responsibility. But anyway, so the world starts veering sharply to the left starting in 1950. And most of the world has pretty well stayed in that trajectory of a severe leftist movement. Taxes in the UK used to be in the normal range, but from 1950 through 1980, taxes went to 80% to 98%. So if you were a wealthier person in the UK, you were looking at 80 to 98% marginal tax rates. They just go crazy. Let's take it all away from the rich, all away from the wealthy, all away from the creator. So the point is, we get to the year 1980. And by the way, I think one of the main reasons the world veered to the left after World War II is that they stepped back and they said, well, maybe socialism does work. I mean, it took an enormous effort to defeat the Germans, enormous effort to defeat the Japanese, two of the more premier economies at that time, and socialism, government planning, top down, command and control, rules and regulations. Hey, maybe Karl Marx is right. Maybe that is the way you should organize an economic system, is top down, command and control, big government. So many nations felt it was worth a try. Certainly Europe veered to the left and went into the European welfare state. Higher taxes, bigger government. Higher taxes, bigger government. And Europe made that move. The United States, although we've inched towards bigger government every year since World War II, it wasn't severe as was the European lurch. So the point is, so now Britain, UK, gets out to the year 1980, and heavily unionized, heavily nationalized. What I mean by nationalization is where the government owns the coal mines, the government owns the oil fields, the government owns the main means of production. So that's all nationalization. The government delivers all the services instead of the private sector. So all of Europe, including the UK, kept moving in this direction. And unfortunately, what people learn either the hard way or the easy way is no matter how much you try it, how much you think it will work, how much you think, let's let the smart people plan the economy. Let's let the smart people design it and lay out the plans, and then the rest of us will all fall in line. That is in contrast to letting the market decide, i.e. millions and millions of people who are builders, creators, dreamers, doers, engineers, entrepreneurs, inventors, blah, 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 blah. Instead of doing it that way, let's have the smart of us make sure we design it. Doesn't work. So in comes Margaret Thatcher. Now, it was an easy time to win the prime ministership of the UK in 1979 because the UK and Europe were in total disarray. In 1979, half of the workers in the UK were on strike. Half the workers. The garbage collectors were on strike for 1 year. The garbage was piling up so much in and around London, you could smell London all the way to Ireland. 225 miles away, you could smell the garbage that was being emitted in London. I mean, it's a bummer when your garbage collectors go on strike. It's really a bummer when your coal miners go on strike because, as you know, you need coal for heat. And they're all on strike. And so it was the cold, toughest winter ever in 1979. And so as an act of genius, Margaret Thatcher runs on the theme that she had just one picture in the newspaper and one picture on television. And that was a picture of the union people, all with their placards, walking around the building or wherever they would like to walk on strike. And the subheading read, "Labor isn't working." So there they are, all on strike. And indeed, she caught it. Labor isn't working. This is not working. This system is not working. So Margaret Thatcher runs on that and she wins. And she starts turning this economy head over heel immediately. She said, what we're going to do is we're going to get a lot of these businesses back in the private sector. Now, Thatcher used the word denationalization. It's a big word. It's way too big. When we got to meet Margaret Thatcher in 1983, our think tank, the National Center for Policy Analysis, was really kind of started because of Thatcher. Steve Forbes had a vision of a free market think tank. Dr. John Goodman, the president of the think tank that I'm part of, he was a great writer on privatization, influential in Chile a number of years earlier, in 1975, 76, and 77, when Pinochet threw out Allende, and then Chile makes the same movement that we're going to talk about Thatcher here in a little bit, but in the middle of the 70s, Pinochet threw out Allende, the communist, killed a bunch of people in the doing of it. 1,100 people were killed, and so he'll never, ever be forgiven for that. And I'm not big in that myself, going around shooting people, especially none in the least shooting 1,100 people, which is no small thing. So I'm not saying that I want you to care or like Pinochet or not. All I know is he threw over a very, throughout a very evil, evil, destroying government. And General Pinochet, for all his faults, had the wisdom to say, I'm a military dictator. All I know how to do is bang, bang, bang. Now I have to run this country because I'm the president of Chile. What do I do now? And some people said, General Pinochet, there are some economists that got their education at the University of Chicago in the United States, and they became known as the Chicago Boys. And there's about 10 of these Chicago Boys that teach here in Santiago at Catholic University, and they've got some great ideas as to where Chile might head. So they went and got the guys. They spent all night talking. Have you ever read John Locke? No. Have you ever read F.A. Hayek? No. Have you ever read Ludwig von Mises? No. Have you ever read Milton Friedman? No. Do you know anything about the Chicago School of Economics? No, no, no. Pinochet, what have you been doing? Shooting people. Got it. Okay. Would you like a brief lecture on free markets, on freedom, on rule of law, on limited government, on blah, blah, blah? And he says, go for it. And so they spent all night visiting with Pinochet, and about 6 o'clock in the morning, after about an 8-hour nonstop lecture on James Madison and Tom Jefferson and F.A. Hayek and the Austrian School of Economics, etc., etc., Pinochet's comment was, let's go for it. So starting in 1975, I got to tell you, there have been no economic miracles in South America. There haven't been. There should have been. Argentina, Brazil, Mexico, all of should have been economic miracles beyond words. Why Mexico? Because they work hard. Why Argentina? Because it's mainly European. Why Brazil? Because it's the most beautiful, big, resource-laden country on the face of the earth. Excuse me. Why shouldn't Argentina, Brazil, and Mexico be top flight, first rate countries? They haven't. It's not happened in South America with one exception, and that's Chile. And Chile began in 1975, and because what they did is they said, no, 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 no more 80% tax rates. We're going to go to 25 or 30% tax rates. No, 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 governments are not going to run everything. We're going to begin to privatize the Social Security system, privatize the welfare system, privatize more and more industries, and all of a sudden, starting in 1975, you see an economic miracle begin to take shape in Chile. It was really quite beautiful from 75 through 1990. Then in 1990, they started electing socialists again and again and again, and then Chile falls back to the mean, the average of South America, i.e. lousy. Lousy economics, lousy economic growth, and Chile falls back to a rate. That's the bad news. The good news is Chile has most recently elected as their president Piñera. Now, Mr. Piñera is a relative of José Piñera, and José Piñera was one of those privatizers, one of those 10 Chicago boys that helped privatize Chile. On November 6th of 1980, Chile privatizes its social security system. I got to tell you something. A few more years from now, Chile is going to be done ever paying Social Security, and everybody is going to be with personal retirement accounts and privatized retirement accounts, and the average Chilean has 10 times as much in their private savings account as does the average American. Really, really, yeah. Still a fairly poor country, and certainly been heading backwards in the last 15 years. But they have elected Panera as a president. He's going to try to reclaim what his cousin did, or a relative of his, same name, Panera, in 1975 as one of the Chicago Boys. So that's just a little background. Now moving up, here's Thatcher. Everything's on strike. Labor isn't working. She wins. And now just some very unique historical things happen. Thatcher becomes the Prime Minister of the UK, one of the most powerful countries in the world. Ronald Reagan becomes President of the United States in 1980. And Pope John Paul II, a critical player here for two reasons. One is we've never had a Catholic pope that has said anything warmly about capitalism. Catholic popes just simply do not like capitalism, and it's easy theologically to understand. They think that capitalism is about greed. They think capitalism is about inequality. They think capitalism is about some rich fat cats, blah, blah. So that's their perception. It probably will never change. But we did have one pope that came out and was a great booster of free markets and capitalism, and that was Pope John Paul II. So at a critical juncture in the world, you know, I think of poor Gorbachev in the Soviet Union. You had Margaret Thatcher, the first time she met Gorbachev, she says, "I want something to be perfectly clear, Mr. Gorbachev. I hate communists. And I hate communism, and I really don't like communists either, and I can't stand socialists." Well, thank you, Ms. Thatcher. Thank you. That's very nice. And then you have, you know, Ronald Reagan at the Berlin Wall saying, "Gorbachev, tear down this wall," you know. And then you have a Pope, John Paul II, that says, "We must rid the world of communism." Holy smokes. So we've got kind of the three most powerful people in the world all aligning: Thatcher, Reagan, and Pope John Paul II. And so it was an interesting alignment as, again, the world now begins to pivot in another direction, away from the left and towards free markets, lower taxes, privatization, deregulation, some rule of law, etc., etc. So what a great time to live between 1982 and 2007. The greatest economic growth period ever in America, and really the greatest economic growth period in the world, because you really see the world, some of the world, beginning to pivot. Certainly not Africa. Then we see the Soviet Union making a pivot. The Berlin Wall collapsed or came down in 1989. And so now the Soviet Union begins to do a pivot. And then we back up in China to the late 70s. Mao Zedong dies. Deng Xiaoping takes over. Deng Xiaoping hears that in some inner province of China there's some wealth creation. So he goes out and says, "What's going on out here?" Well, Mr. Deng Xiaoping, I will tell you this. We found out that to collectivize agriculture doesn't work. To have all of us own it isn't working. So we've divided up all the plots, and everybody has individual responsibility to work the land, and whatever they make, they get to keep. And so all of a sudden you have some market and capitalism going on. It's getting rich. And now he can either have them all killed or saying, maybe we should change. And I think the reason why he says we will change is not because he was so impressed by this pocket of wealth that was being created in China, but I think he was overwhelmed by what he saw in Hong Kong and Singapore, in particular, Chinese. All Chinese, same blood as Mother China, and yet Hong Kong becoming the richest place on the face of the earth on a per capita income. And just between you and me, and so we all have to say it over and over, why? Why did Hong Kong do that well? Well, just a hint. I wonder if it has anything to do with a 15% flat tax. I wonder. I just wonder, could it possibly be? Well, I tell you what, 40 countries have now gone to a low flat tax. Guess who's going to go someday? Not in the next 3 years. No, not in the next 3 years. And maybe not in the next 13 years. I don't know. But flat tax, please. Please. It works. So isn't it nice to know that there's something out there that eventually we're going to say, well, maybe it's time the United States. But anyway, that's a whole other question. So now, we're back. And Deng Xiaoping, he saw the success of Hong Kong. He saw the success of Singapore with their flat tax and their lightly regulated economy and their ability to have low tariffs and move to free trade. And he sees miracles, and he begins to shift China. He did it fairly quickly. He moved China in some of his first laws, late 1970s, to give 30 and 50 year leases on the land. Now, that's not ownership, admittedly, but that's as close to ownership as you can get when the government says, here's a 30 year lease, do something with it. And so it started there, and it's just increased. He then starts saying, maybe people should be allowed to move where they want to move. Maybe people should be allowed to buy and sell where they want to buy and sell. So, and the Chinese are so industrious and such hard working people and so on. So you begin to see a movement as China comes out of abject poverty and begins to move towards prosperity. So now back now to Thatcher. She's now got this country. She's changing it. But I've got to tell you, she's hated beyond words by a significant segment of people in the UK. In November, I went to Wales and spent a week in Wales. I'm telling you, the average person in Wales doesn't dislike Margaret Thatcher. They hate Margaret Thatcher. They absolutely insist that she destroyed the coal industry. By destroying the unions, she destroyed the coal industry, and Wales is very, very, very dependent on coal. And in some ways, Wales has not really recovered. And so they totally, totally blame Thatcher for that. So Thatcher has picked up some enemies along the way, and I want to give you a couple of her quotes in case you haven't heard them. She says, as she becomes the first female prime minister ever, and still, that's still true today, in the world, really, it may be that the cock crows, but it is the hen who lays the eggs. And so she was just marvelous. Thatcher says, being powerful is like being a lady. If you have to tell people who you are, you aren't. That's so concise. I'll say that again. Being powerful is like being a lady. If you have to tell people you are, you aren't. She calls herself a consensus politician. She's not a consensus politician, but a conviction politician. Thatcher says that if you set out to be liked, you will accomplish nothing. Thatcher has probably spoken to more audiences that heckled her, interrupted her, put her down than any speaker in the history of the world. They hassled her incessantly. One time, 350 economists wrote a full page article in the London Times, and they said, Thatcher, your denationalization, your privatization, your lower taxes, your less government, it's a failure. It's a failure. Turn, Margaret, turn. So the headline says, 350 economists ask Thatcher for a U-turn. Her very next speech, she stands in front of a couple thousand people. Turn if you might,
this lady isn't for turning. The Iron Lady. I mean, she decided what she was going to do with the UK, and nothing was going to change her mind. When she finished her prime ministership in 1991, she came to the United States for a set of lectures. And because we got to know her in the privatization efforts in the 1980s, I went with her on four different occasions to speak. I just happened to be in Atlanta a number of weeks after 9/11. And it was a sad time for America. And Thatcher stands up and without notes utters this sentence and then proceeds to speak a whole another hour and 15 minutes, just like the sentence you're now going to hear. These merchants of terror must be made to pay a price so high they can never again consider such wanton acts of human carnage. I mean, a country boy? I couldn't say it that way. I would say, shoot him. That's about as good as I could get, and that's not a catchy phrase. Thatcher can talk like that for hour on hours and no notes and use that. She knows the whole Websters. That's my first problem. I've got a 5,000-word working vocabulary, and that's all. She's got probably a 150,000-word. So it is just unbelievable as Thatcher stands before people and tries to convince them verbally. So the UK makes a nice turn, starts growing economically. Instead of being a museum, it becomes a place of dynamism and entrepreneurship and active economics. And so the UK made a nice turn in the 1990s. It's throwing it all away also by going back to socialist leaders. So the UK then is setting right now where the United States is setting in this sense. The problem in the UK and the problem in the United States is, believe it or not, democracy. Wait, I thought democracy was the answer to everything. No, democracy is not the answer to everything. Democracy is a fundamentally unstable system. It's fundamentally unstable because 51% can vote to take everything that the 49% have produced. Now, such a deal, but it's the truth. James Madison, who wrote most of the Constitution of the United States, John Adams, James Madison said, "We've designed this government to protect freedom from democracy and the individual from the majority." And so our founding fathers saw the instability of democracy. Our founding fathers saw that 51% could take 49. They saw that a government big enough to give you everything you want is big enough to take everything that you have. That a government always offering the helping hand almost inevitably becomes the controlling hand. That a bigger government means a smaller individual. A bigger government means a smaller citizen. And so it is why Thatcher was so interested in denationalization or privatization, because she knew that the more you could get economic power back in the hands of individuals, corporations, and people, the more you would defang and government. The more you move to the free market, the more power you gave to individuals and different economic players throughout the strata of an economic system. So it made lots and lots of sense to do that. For Margaret Thatcher, even though she was the consummate politician, for her the definition of politics was poly, means many, ticks, a blood-sucking insect. And it was James Madison who said that democracy is just simply two wolves and one sheep voting on what we're going to have for dinner. Here's the problem. There's two ways to make a living. One way, called work, describes most of you. But there's another way to make a living, and it's called stealing and or voting. Stealing is a great labor-saving device. Think about it. Let someone else work and produce and create, and then you come in and you steal it. Easy. Human beings will take that more than not. So the crisis of democracy right now is this, that elections have just simply become auctions on the auctioneer that promises the most can win the votes. So when it comes to politicians, their palms are soft, their grip lacks clout, yet they win votes with each handout. The problem with democracy is right now, for most persons, they say, divide the wealth, spread it about, sharing is no sin. When mine runs out, I plan to shout, let's divvy up again. Again. Let's divvy up again. And again. Grudem's class got to say something. When government begins to attack the rich, the main people that take the brunt of that are the poor, because when you attack the rich, you really smack the poor in the face. The rich, take Bill Gates, take $80 billion. Bill Gates, even if he eats lobster every day, and even if he buys a new Mercedes-Benz every day, and even if he adds a new room to his house every day, he still only consumes that much of $80 billion. It's amazing how much $1 billion can buy. But anyway, so what does Gates do then with his $80 billion? Lobster? Bigger home? Are you kidding me? How's this for a start? How about giving $4 or $5 billion to Africa for malaria and AIDS? How about putting money in savings that comes out, and now there's all kinds of jobs created because of Bill Gates, on and on. So when you attack Bill Gates, you really attack the poor. Maybe that doesn't follow logically for you, and maybe I didn't state it as clear as I want to, and I really hope to learn how to state that very, very clearly. And the reason why I'd like to do that is because I think that people like me have let down the fight for freedom in a significant way, because we, people like me, economists, we keep arguing in terms of economic efficiency, we keep arguing in terms of economic prosperity, we keep arguing in terms of when you go to the free market, people will be more prosperous. When you go to the free market, look at East Berlin, West Berlin. In West Berlin, there's freedom. In East Berlin, there was not. More freedom, more bread. South Korea, North Korea. South Korea, more freedom. North Korea, less freedom. 10 times, 20 times richer down here in South Korea than North Korea. More freedom, more bread. Free markets, efficiency, economic prosperity. It's there for anyone who wants to see. So that's been my message for 30 years. The mistake there is that our young people, especially our young people, anybody probably under the age of 30 on down, they don't care so much about the efficiency and prosperity arguments. They care about the morality of the arguments, and they truly believe that inequality is one of the biggest problems facing the world, and the only thing that can create more equality is for government to take from you so that government can give to them, and therefore there will be more equality. And so young people, that is, they care about the morality of capitalism. Is it right? Is it moral? Which then leads me then into the passage that we're going to look at today, Proverbs 31. Now, I am so blessed to be around a guy like Grudem. What I got to write the initial part of the chapter, and then Wayne gets to write it really well, rewrite mine really well, and then I've killed myself on 13 or 14 aspects of freedom. This part of freedom, and this part of freedom, and this part. And I had 13 or 14. And I just so excitedly handed it to Grudem. And so Wayne polished this. And oh boy, did he polish it. He not only polished it, but he added 15 more. Where do you come up with that stuff, Grudem? So he's just nothing short of an intellectual's intellectual, and yet humble beyond words. And isn't that what you just love about some people, when they can be so smart and so humble and so kind and so generous? But that's how I view Wayne. And so he polishes and polishes. So Wayne says, Barry, here's what we're going to do. We're going to write this book on poverty. The Poverty of Nations is the title of the book. But Barry, really the big beneficiaries of this book will not necessarily be the people in poverty, although we certainly hope that it can make a difference. But we've really got to change the idea of the choir. We've got to get the choir singing on the same, have the choir having the same hymn book and singing the same verses. In other words, somehow, some way, we've got to get the average pastor and the average congregant to understand the free market and how critical the free market is in solving the poverty question. The free market doesn't solve you and I's poverty question, because the free market has already solved you and my poverty question. It already has done that. So now, for our youth and for our youngsters, if that's really where they're coming from, is they want more quality. The average 20-year-old, honest to goodness, wants more government, not less. The average 20-year-old, honestly, wants higher taxes, not lower taxes. They don't even have the song book, much less singing off the song page. And so what might it be that begins to change that attitude? Well, I got to tell you, if you say Wayne Grudem said it, so what? Barry Asma said it, so what? Steve Forbes says it, so what? A bunch of so what? But when you invoke God, when you're able to say, look at, see what God says in Genesis 1:27 about telling all of us to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and exercise dominion over everything that moves, and that God wants us to flourish. See that He's created man and woman, and He cares every bit as much about the female as He does about the male. Male, female, created in His image, created them. Read Genesis 23, the whole chapter, Genesis 23, about where Sarah dies. Abraham is going to bury Sarah. He needs some land to bury Sarah. And the surrounding people, not Jews at all, so care for Abraham that said, Abraham, we will give you the land. We will just give it to you. Bury her. We'll give you a nice plot. How much do you want? 5 acres, 50 acres, 5,000 acres? Tell us, Abraham, we'll give it to you. And in Genesis 23, Abraham says, no, I do not want you to give it to me. I want to buy it. I want to own it. I want to hold that land in perpetuity, and I can only do that if it is mine. Bingo, private ownership. Exodus chapter 20, the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not steal. What does that mean? That means that if you have something, it's not mine. It's yours. And I'm not allowed to take it because it's not mine. It's yours. Private property. Private ownership. It is yours. So the point is, I meet Grudem, and I'm aware of a few things in the Bible that strengthen the case for free markets, strengthen the case for private ownership, that strengthen the case for rule of law, etc., etc. I know of just a few, because I don't know this book the way Wayne Grudem knows this book. And so lo and behold, this guy starts writing, and I just say, where did you get that? Where did you get that? Where did you get... It's just wonderful. And what's so fun is co-authors, some people are going to think I'm partly responsible. They couldn't be more wrong. But we're not going to tell anybody, are we? We'll just all keep that as a secret, because this is the biggest joke of the century. My name is going to be on the book with him, and it's all his ideas. And I get to have half credit and half the royalties. We haven't talked about that yet, but I know Wayne's heart will be more of mine is on that. And, you know, if by God's grace that the book does well, obviously that's not our money. It's not our money. It's God's money. We're going to use it for what God wants. That's going to be a blast. But anyway, that's another question. Okay, here we go. Proverbs 31. You didn't think that this is a great case for... free markets. Watch what you see as we begin to read. And we're going to start with verse 10. And where did Ron go? Ron, where are you? Back. Oh, how much time do I have?
15 minutes.
15 minutes. Okay. Here we go. Proverbs 31, starting with verse 10. We'll be in the ESV. Why not, huh? You thought I was going to read out of a Living Bible, didn't you? An excellent wife who can find so is far more precious than jewels. The heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not harm all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and works with willing hands. She is like the ships of the merchant. She brings her food from afar. She rises while it is yet night and provides food for her household and portions for her maidens. She considers a field and buys it with the fruit of her hands, and she plants a vineyard. She dresses herself with strength and makes her arms strong. She perceives that her merchandise is profitable. Her lamp does not go out at night. She puts her hands to the distaff, and her hands hold the spindle. She opens her hand to the poor and reaches out her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household are clothed in scarlet. She makes bed coverings for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. He's a judge. She makes the linen garments and sells them. She delivers sashes to the merchant. Strength and dignity are her clothing, and she laughs at the time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and the reaching of kindness is on her tongue. She looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many women have done excellently, but you surpass them all. Charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hands, and let her works praise her in the gates. So we have this wonderful Proverbs 31 woman, creative, excellent, energetic, compassionate, giving, helps the poor, loves her husband, he trusts her, she loves him. Wow. Now, if I was a woman and I read Proverbs 31, I would say, I think I'm going to cash in the chips. Give me a break. I'll take all my women friends, and they don't equal a Proverbs 31. Exactly. Neither does any man. This is written for men and women, too, but it uses the woman here. Now, this, so I am going to let Wayne Grudem, in the putting together of the ESV Bible, can you imagine the fun that Wayne had as he got to kind of hand select, let's see, who do I want to do some commentary on the Proverbs 31 woman? Bigger, who do I want to do the main commentary on the book of Proverbs? And Wayne gets to choose any one or two or three or five individuals that he considers to be some of the best and most informed people in the Greek and the Hebrew in these various books. So he got to choose his favorite people for the book of Acts and for every book in the Bible. And so now Wayne is sitting in this kind of command control center, and he's having all these folks do all this magnificent research and writing as it comes in to his office. And he, being the general editor of the ESV Study Bible, got to make the choice whether to keep it, to not keep it, or to revise it. And trust me, I know what revising all is about with this last 2 years and my writing. You can imagine what you'd have to do. Let's start, not quite start over, but almost. So Wayne did that. So he sat in that position and watched these wonderful writers come in on these. So here's what these writers say about this as just some generalized thinking about the excellence of the human being and the excellence of wifely excellence and a woman. Wayne says that this wisdom here now in this is acrostic, in which each verse begins with successive letters of the Hebrew alphabet. Does anybody know how many letters there are in the Hebrew alphabet? Do you want to say? 22? Do I hear a different number? 21. I think we're going to settle in at 21. So, who am I to say? 21, 22. I'll go with the lady over here, Wayne. No. Okay, 21. Okay, so the point is, the wisdom poem is an acrostic in which each verse begins with successive letter of the Hebrew alphabet. The poem begins and ends with the mention of the woman's excellence. The probable intention of putting this together with the acrostic pattern is to show that this woman's character runs the whole range of excellence. No one woman would be this excellent. The woman is married. She is devoted to the well-being of her household. She contributes to the participation of the communities and outside economic concerns, as many women even in this. So, yes, but my, to be this kind of a woman, that bright, that creative, that enterprising, gets up early in the morning, stays up late at night, trades with the traders, becomes an excellent entrepreneur. And in verse 20, cares, opens her hand to the poor and reaches out to those that are needy, verse 20. And what she does for her own family, that if there's going to be snow, i.e. it's going to be cold, i.e. they can't wear linen, that's not very warm, they'll be in wool. So wool takes color very wise, so it's going to be some kind of dyed wool, probably even maybe purples, etc. So that's the woman that we're talking about here in this acrostic. And she is a typecast. when we read about Joseph in the 37th chapter through the 50th chapter of Genesis, the more we read about Joseph, that in some kind of a special way, he really was a type of Christ. I mean, his great heart of being thrown in a pit to be killed by the animals, or to be sold off to the slave traders, and now is going to be forever separated from his family, and he has to learn a whole new language and a whole new set of people, and so on. All those things, to be in Potiphar's household, and he didn't make a move on her, but she made a move on him, but then she blames him. Next thing you know, he gets thrown in jail. So bad thing after bad thing after bad thing. And yet the heart of Joseph, a type of Christ. Jesus, Isaiah, 500-600 years before Jesus, he was wounded for our transgressions, bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was on him, and with his stripes we are healed. That's the Jesus. The Jesus that could turn the other cheek. The Jesus who suffered beyond words and yet took it. In many ways, Joseph went through some of that. None the least to say, Jesus sold for 30 pieces of silver, and then same kinds of change when it comes to Joseph. So there's so many similarities of Joseph and Jesus. So in one rough sort of way, he's the type of Christ. He's not Christ. The Proverbs 31 woman is not perfect, not claimed to be. But what are the kind of characteristics that you would like to see? Obviously, Joseph got a little bit twisted in kind of a perverted idea there at the very end where he plays the trick on his brothers. I mean, Joseph, I wish that wasn't there, but be that as it may, that's so human, isn't it? And Joseph is just a sinning human also, as you and I are. But so God uses these acrostics a number of times to teach us some wonderful lessons. And using the Proverbs woman, he is really teaching us about the capable wife. He's teaching us how he not only trusts her, but she trusts him. And teaching us something about work. She does it with a smile on her face. She does it with joy in her heart. And there is nothing like a conscious purpose to really bring delight. Today we have a great writer at the American Enterprise Institute who's talking about earned success. The only people that really are happy are those that have earned success. And it's kind of interesting. He goes and looks at all the former lottery winners. And it's absolutely stunning to see that 1 year or 2 years or 5 years after you've won $2 million, $5 million, $10 million, $25 million, $50 million, $100 million, to see the incredible unhappiness. How could you possibly be unhappy after winning $5 million? And Brewer answers, because it's not earned success. And so we have to be very, very careful then with entitlements, that all of a sudden gifts become entitlements, and entitlements become, I deserve it, it's mine. What? Are we building any kind of character of work and trust and so on when we play those kinds of entitlement games? So we read of this woman, great success. She works hard. You know, in verse 16 it says she considers a field and buys it. Well, I've never bought any. I bought a house, but that's about the biggest thing I've ever purchased is a house. But she considers a field. And so when it says consider, all the ramifications of what it takes to get a mental value on what that's worth and then maybe what I might do with it after I own it. So I stand in awe of some of you in this classroom who are entrepreneurs. I stand in awe that you can manage all the plates that you can manage. You can have a company here and here and here and here and lots of employees, and they're able to keep track of all of this and do it. So it is an absolute gifting of God. God has just blessed you with certain skill sets. When you see Jeff Goebel do what Jeff Goebel does, he's the chairman of our elders right now. Jeff is running bunches of companies. He's busy from 5 in the morning till 11 o'clock at night. And yet always cheerful and always making room for God's work. Now, Jeff and Tracy needed to run the Compelled by Grace thing. They needed that like they needed a hole in the head. They had just finished the 50th anniversary of this church. They had put in hundreds of hours. They were tired. They were very tired. But we've got to find someone who's going to chair this. And the person that's going to chair Compelled by Grace is going to have to do their job plus another 40-hour week job. And the last person in the world that you would think that would volunteer for this would be Jeff and Tracy Goebel. And they did. And I don't know if you watched how that whole thing unfolded, but have you ever seen a more compelling, well done vision for church? Now, admittedly, the vision were elders. We started praying on this on 5 years ago. And as we began to pray, we thought, you know what? We're not going to pray in our chairs. We're going to pray on our knees. And so we bought some knee pads. And so for about 2 years, we're on our knees. Some of us were having a harder and harder time doing that. Could we just sit and pray instead of getting on our knees and pray? So we took the easy way out after 2 years. Okay, and besides, we could hear each other then. Because when you're sitting in a chair, you pray, but when your head is down and you're praying right at the floor. So there's a couple nice things to do when you are sitting. But we prayed. God, you are blessing special needs like we can't believe, and we need more room. God, we're going to kill our pastor having him preach 4 times every Sunday. We're going to kill him doing this. So if we can divide this up, how about Saturday night becoming big and senior pastor, you'll have it. Twice on Sunday instead of 4 times on Sunday. So just helpful there. God, we'd love to have a face to Shea Boulevard. Thousands, tens of thousands of people drive down Shea. They don't even know there's a church over here. They think that these are all office buildings over here. To have a chapel there, it's lit up at night. Can't you just see it lit up at night? Can't you just see it being manned 24 hours a day? Can't you just see people driving by and saying, I bet I can find Jesus in there. No kidding, Lone Ranger. So does that just make your heart jump? The special needs, does that make your heart jump? And on and on. And besides, some of these buildings, not this one, but some of these buildings are getting old. And they need some refurbishing, etc., etc., etc. That's the smallest part of the thing. But it will set us for how this church wants to reach out and operate very, very effectively for the next 50 years. So we get a Proverbs 31 woman, and we just go to our knees and say, oh God, thank you. And it's keyed right at the very end where it says in verse 30, she's a woman who fears the Lord. That's why she's the Proverbs 31 woman. She fears the Lord. She loves the Lord. It's all about the Lord. It's all being conformed to the image of Jesus Christ. It's all looking to the Holy One who never acted holier than thou. Jesus, how did you do that? looking to the one who knew it all, and yet he never acted like a know-it-all. Why is it you, Barry, every time you learn anything, you've got to share it with someone? You can hardly wait. Look at what he knows. Oh, gee, that's so cool. To the one who owns it all. He owns the cattle on a thousand. He owns it all. And he never strutted. He was never proud. Had the same attitude that it was in Christ Jesus, and that though he was God, did not consider equality with God as something to be grasped, but he was willing to become a bondservant, to become a human, to dwell among us, and he humbled himself to death, even death on a cross. Oh God, you are so wonderful. I was so moved to be in church this morning to understand that as we look at Galatians, this is perfect. Yes, we all know, for by grace are ye saved through faith. We all know that salvation is nothing that we can do. We get that. We get that. Salvation is all him, nothing us. All Jesus, zero. Got it. Got it. But to add that other part, that now that grace is here to sanctify us. In other words, as you and I now get to move through our next level of Christian growth, God only knows we need grace and we need help as God is conforming us from eternity to eternity. And he's moving us more to the image of Christ. And of course, the more that we become like Christ, the more we see how dark our hearts are. The more you come to bring a white light, the more you see yourself. There's no question that the person in this, if there be some way to measure this, the person in this room who loves Jesus the most and has the best heart is also the person in this room that sees the darkness of their own hearts. See, we don't see ourselves. We don't see ourselves. I wish we did. That's why, thank God, God gives us a wife. Because if I wouldn't have got married, I would have thought I was perfect. And God has given this woman to me to help me understand. Barry, 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 what were you thinking? I wasn't. What were you doing? Bad. I get, you know, Barry, Barry, there were 20 people in that room tonight. Do you feel that you did your share of talking? I thought it was a good question. I said, yeah, I think I got in my share. Well, you darn right you got in your share, and 99% of everybody else's share too. What are you thinking? What are you thinking? What do you think they're saying this very moment as they're driving home right now? He is a big blabbermouth. That's what he is. Blah, 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 blah. What are you doing? What are you doing? Then she would get off of it and just love me. She knew I needed it. She knew she had to put her arms on me and say, okay, tomorrow's tomorrow. Then when I did it tomorrow, she'd wonder why she has to give the same lecture again. We're slow at seeing ourselves, aren't we? I don't see anybody nodding, so I'll just confess it's my problem. I'm very slow at seeing my weaknesses, and I've got plenty. And Mandy would be happy to give you a list of all those. So, Proverbs 31 is going to be so helpful to us as Rick Warren opens it up and sees what Grudem has to say and gets so excited about the poverty of nations that he says, every seminary and every pastor should have this book. That'll be a good first page. God bless him. But Wayne knows how to weave in. God says it. Not man says it. God says it. This is what God says about private ownership. This is what God says about free enterprise. Look at the Proverbs 31 woman. This is what God says about rule of law. But this is what God says about all the big dimensions of life. Do we enjoy work or we don't enjoy work? Should we? Yes. And is there glory in whether we're a bricklayer or we're putting on the top part of a steeple of a wonderful church? It doesn't make any difference. It's all for the glory of God. Work is wonderful. It's important to work. I'll close by saying, are we so fortunate to be born in a country where some other founding fathers came up with the idea of limited government, came up with the idea of economic freedom, came up with the idea of we the people, came up with the idea of rule of law, came up with the idea of titles, deeds, and articles of incorporation, came up with the idea of protected property rights, came up with the idea of work hard, who came up with the idea, and then with those set of ideas, and then the Bible coming up with the idea of savings, it's smart to save. It's smart to invest. It's smart to work hard. Yes, time has meaning. Yes, every moment has meaning. Yes, we move from Genesis through Revelation like this. And it's not like this, but like this. We're moving somewhere. Every day has meaning. Make the most out of every day. Be loving God, loving your spouse, loving your family, loving every day. Today is the accepted day of salvation, and it's also the accepted day of sanctification and continuing growing in Him. People are waving at me. I think they're saying hi. Father in heaven, be with the Grudems as they're going to have a good weekend and have had. And thank you that this wonderful class that's been around for a long time and is faithful, and what this class accomplishes with what you have given them. Lord, even Margaret Thatcher said that Jesus' parable of the Good Samaritan wouldn't have lasted very long had it not be that the Good Samaritan had more than just good intentions. He also had money. So you give us money. You bless us with money. You bless us with prosperity. Oh God, that we're worthy. Oh God, that we don't cling to money. Oh God, that we see that everything that we have is clay, your hands to be used for your kingdom. And it's not how much of my money I give to God, but how much of God's money I spend on myself. God, continue to refine that view in my head and my heart. Let Mandy and I know what you want us to spend on ourselves, and let us know what you want that we use your money for the glory of God. In Jesus' name, amen.